Right, hello, hello, hello. I wonder what the levels are like on this. Let's check. Wanted to kickstart this again. That's why I'm back. Planning on talking to a few people as I begin the process of writing the next book. Next book is excitingly titled "The Hopeless University: colon, colons are important, intellectual work at the end of history." And I suppose I want to just sort of test out that idea, the meaning behind hopeless and hopelessness, and what I'm pushing towards with that. So I'm going to start this off on Monday next week. I'm going to talk to my compadre Rob Wheel, who's makes music, publishes that under Ray Elbow and the Magic Beans, does some of the music for this, and going to have a bit of chat with him about the creative process, about the politics of his work, about ideas around hopeful despair. So the new book is that's going to be with Mayfly. It's going to be with Mayfly Books. They publish ephemera, journal ephemera. It's kind of, unless you want a hard copy, it's green open access. That's very important. It's a radical imprint. They've already published a couple of pieces on higher ed from Tony Ruska on universities and reproduction and ecological crisis, which is great, and Ansgar Allen's book on the cynical educator with a focus on Nietzsche. So I like what they're trying to do, I like what they're about. I want to contribute to that. I think it's important that we push that agenda, that sort of radical, open form of intellectual activity. So that's important. So I'm going with them. Wasn't really interested in pitching it to, I was considering pitching it to John Hopkins, or maybe Duke, but then you sort of think, well, maybe I want to, maybe supporting a sort of a peer-reviewed, academic-driven, local, Leicester-based publishing house. Really important. Feels to me it's important. Maybe I want to talk to Rob about that. Given that he's a maker of electroacoustic, he's a maker of he's a he's, he samples. He used to be a dancer. There's a definite creative artistic thing that is kind of that is also digital and homegrown and home produced and home sampled and all of that carefully done with and professionally done, as professionally or crafted. Maybe professional is the wrong word. Is that the wrong word? I wonder if that's the wrong word. It's crafted. There's a craft in there, it's crafted, and that's what I'm interested in. So yeah, I'm going to talk to him, going to write this book, I'm going to talk to Sarah. Sarah's coming to talk to Sarah Amsler about a year on from the last book launch. Going to talk to her about her work, in particular in feminist spaces that are looking to critique kind of dominant myths around education and society. So I want to talk to her about that. I want to talk to her about hopelessness as well. And I think that this hopelessness thing has kind of erupted or emerged from one of the chapters in the Alienated Academic are about Weltschmerz and this idea of a kind of world pain, the pain of the world, the scream of the world. It's the scream of the world. It's Munch's scream. It's the thing that John Holloway wrote about around the time that he was thinking about how to change the world without taking power, about the scream. And I feel like it's to an extent a scream of hopelessness, born of the pain of living and working and existing in the university at a time of extreme crisis. So, while we talk about this, my compadres and colleagues at other institutions are on strike. We're not on strike because we didn't hit the threshold. We were 5 votes short. And our colleagues across the sector in UCU are on strike over equal pay, over gender imbalances, which are a disgrace, over casualisation, increasing use of precarious contracts, part-time contracts, and obviously this has a big impact on PhD students and their hopes for a career, and postgraduates who teach, and the fact that they are living precarious. A lot of them are living precarious and temporary lives, are trying to beg, steal, and borrow, are overworking. So there's a workload thing in here as well. And that makes me reflect on the fact that Mary Beard tweeted at the weekend about working 100-hour week. And that she felt a mug, but wondered whether that was, how does that relate to the rest of the sector? And that really makes me think about some of the work I did with Kate Bowles back in the day about the idea of the academic peloton, and thinking about the way in which the peloton in professional cycling is calibrated around the leaders of teams and their competition with each other, and it's also catalyzed around the yellow jersey or the Maya Rosa or the red jersey in the Vuelta a España and their performance. And so if they dope or if they overperform based on kind of marginal gains and they utilize new technology to get those gains, then everybody else has to as well. So this idea of working 100-hour week is toxic. This idea of work, rather than calling yourself out, you call yourself out that you're a mug. And part of me thinks, hell, Mary, you know what I mean? You need to go talk to someone. There's plenty of therapists out there, and I'm sure you can afford it. Go do that thing, because 100-hour week is just a chronic form of culturally acceptable self-harm. In fact, it's culturally unacceptable self-harm. The kind of self-harm that we accept in terms of workload is generally, those people who are working 50, 60, 70 hours, and the amount of kind of surplus labor that gets poured into the university is just an outrage, isn't it? And it's accepted, and it recalibrates us, and it recalibrates us around people who look like Mary Beard or who look like me, who are white, who are high performing. I'm not saying the stuff that I produce is any good, right? But I just produce a lot of stuff. That we are able, we appear to be able-bodied. We appear to have no caring responsibilities, and the system can kind of look at us in that way. And that this is a hopeless situation. It's hopeless in kind of both respects of being hopeless. It's hopeless in that it's a hopeless situation. How do we get out of this situation? But it's also hopeless in terms of, oh my God, you are hopeless. There is no hope in you. There is no salvation in you. Your model for existence does not give us any form of kind of salvation. It tells us everything that is wrong or bad about higher education and about productivity and overperformance and overcommitment to perform in that space. I saw the same. There was a tweet maybe a year ago from some Harvard professor stating that postdocs or people who wanted to get a job in a lab in an institution effectively needed to give everything to the institution, and they needed to kind of effectively neglect themselves, the idea of themselves, because if they weren't in the lab all hours of the day and at weekends, then they didn't deserve tenure. They didn't deserve to move on in their careers. And it's just absolutely abject, utterly abject. And it reminds me of I guess of kind of been reading a bit of Althusser, really. Not that I'm an Althusserian. I've been thinking about kind of in particular issues around, as I'm thinking about the book, I'll talk to you about the book in a second, but the issues around the book in terms of kind of whether the university offers any hope for kind of transitional demands away from capitalism and away from a toxic workload culture. Does it, or actually do we need to be more revolutionary or not? So I've been reading some Althusser. I've been thinking about transition. I've been thinking about a revolution. I've been thinking about, in particular, Marx's critique of the Gotha program, which is like amazing. And gives us that kind of sense of, well, how might we, if we're thinking about communes and we're thinking about the work he did at the end of his career on the ethnographic manuscripts, what ways beyond the state might and beyond state-based infrastructures, ideological state apparatus, if we're thinking about Althusser, what might that also potentially is a deeply regressive apparatus and is a repressive apparatus at the same time, because it's deeply in cahoots with state-based actors that want to discipline us. Then what are we then how might we think about the ways in which we combine at the level of the commune or the community or the family or whatever it is in order to build something different? Anyway, I've been thinking about Althusser quite, sort of thinks about Lenin quite a lot. Takes a lot from Lenin in terms of his relationship to Marx and the relationship between historical materialism as a science and dialectical materialism as a kind of philosophical position, the relationship then to Hegel and thinking about dialectics. I'm off beat there a little bit, but he talks. I love this statement from Lenin that the social status of professors in bourgeois society is such that only those are allowed to hold such posts who sell science to serve the interests of capital. And that's all I see in anybody saying, any professor who says, I work 100 hours and I'm a mug, what do? Or any professor who says, if you're not fully invested completely, the whole of yourself in your laboratory, then you don't deserve tenure. These people are simply here to sell science to serve the interests of capital. They just further that. It furthers those kinds of approaches, just further our own collective dehumanization. And it's those sorts of issues that I'm really interested in this kind of this next book, The Hopeless University. Part of it's triggered, I think, definitely and part of like wanting to speak about this today was triggered by the fact that yesterday I was speaking in Manchester at a safeguarding student mental health thing for open forum events. There were a lot of people in there who were in the morning who were speaking about the kind of the technologies, the ways of working, the mentoring schemes, the CBT type schemes, the virtual reality approaches that they got towards the curriculum. So it might be about group work and compassion in working in groups, or it might be about what do we do to support students with eating disorders, for instance. And there was a lot of this going on in the morning, and I kind of felt a bit out of place and thought, oh my God, and I'm coming here to kind of talk about marketization and effectively kind of the breakdown of the educational project. How do I, if we're thinking in Hegelian terms, kind of how am I going to relate the kind of my that kind of a sense of what is universal, what is conceptually going on here? And I'm always quite taken with Sara Ahmed's note from, I think it's from Living a Feminist Life, where she writes that theory can do more the closer it gets to the skin. So I was like really interested in how does my kind of universal theoretical conceptual position, how does that interrelate with everything that we've heard during in the morning, which is very particular. It's a kind of a some of it's a scream of rage around issues to do with student suicide, and some of it is a scream of powerlessness, and some of it is a sense of, well, we can put in interventions as fixes for the kind of symptomatic crisis that we've got, and that is symbolic almost of our way of trying to address these issues because we feel powerless to address the root cause. But part of it is also symbolic of our powerlessness, our helplessness, our hopelessness, that to a large extent, we can only imagine putting in place interventions or support systems inside a university that's become hopeless. It cannot help us. It cannot help us deal with these crises, these issues of the self, of self-identity, of the climate, of overwork, of austerity, of poverty, of grinding, gnawing, clawing, inhumane poverty, of ongoing racism throughout society, crisis of migration. And so part of me was coming from there in this kind of session yesterday. I was reflecting again very much on this article I wrote with Kate, who's over in Wollongong, over in Australia, and around where we wrote about the idea that the university is an anxiety machine. Now I fleshed that out a little bit in the Alienated Academic, but we don't theorize it to any sort of huge extent. But really, the kind of conversation yesterday for me was a number of things, but a couple of things that were really important was How do you exist when you are ill inside institutions and inside a sector that distorts everything around productivity, human capital, value for money, efficiency, effectiveness, impact, excellence, student satisfaction, and inside which everything is measured, where government regulators just want to measure. So for me, it's kind of how do you survive if you're ill? If you have mental health issues, if you are just struggle with plain old boring chronic anxiety and depression, and I don't mean that facetiously because that's what I struggle with for a long time. How do you move? How do you exist? How do you survive? Do you do what Moton and Harney describe, and do you kind of find your undercommons, and do you become a fugitive inside the institution? Do you disconnect yourself and do the minimum in order to survive? Do you quit? There's lots of stuff about quitlet, lots of people quitting the academy. What did you go off sick? What do you do? And I started yesterday by thinking about the fact that it's notionally a humane place. It's notionally a it's a space that it's a machine that enables us to meet our desires. I was thinking about bell hooks, and I was thinking about her focus on the intellectual and spiritual growth of our students being reflected in our own souls and our students' souls. And this is quite an intimate set of relationships where we learn to be and become. And the fact that it's become performative and it's become proletarianized and it's become commodified, and that this disjuncture between value and values, between humanity and inhumanity, it's kind of catalyzed a rise in anxiety, a rise in ill health, a rise in quitting. There are ways in which I think about that in particular in terms of kind of Marx and Engels write about the constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of social conditions, all that is solid melts into air. The real conditions of your relations with yourself, your kind, your work, the things you produce is all of a sudden made real. And I think about this because institutions are being remade over and over again with new technologies, new ways of working, organizational development, workload plans, workload planning, algorithms, new approaches to personal tutoring, ref, teaching excellence, research impact, National Student Survey, all of this is co it's constant. It's constant. That's beyond business as usual. And it's no wonder that people are struggling with stress and anxiety through chronic overwork, and that their home lives are being dismantled. So if you look like me, and you look able-bodied, white, male, professor, notionally productive, don't appear to have any caring relationships, then you can perform. You can perform as required. And if you say you work 100 hours a week, well then that becomes the norm, right? So, and in part, this is about absolute surplus value. We'll just extend the working day and we'll get more surplus thrown in. It also becomes about relative surplus value because we are all in competition with each other at the level of the individual, at the level of the discipline, at the level of the institution. Everything is in competition. It is just that most awful, as Engels says, in the condition of the working class in England, it is that inhumane battle of all against all. And what it means is that, if we think about Audre Lorde and her kind of plea, her cry, her demand that self-preservation is an act of warfare, we need to think about that. We need to think about calling out people who say you must be in the laboratory for 16, 18 hours a day because you're not going to get tenure otherwise. We need to call that out. It's toxic and it's inhumane. And we therefore need to think about our labour. And we need to think about our labour in order to go on strike, we need to think about labour in order to push back. And we need to think about our labour in order to have conversations with our students. And we need to think about our labour in order to engage with that idea that's raised by Postone, amongst others, that actually this is not a critique of capitalism from the point of labor. This is not a critique of the capitalist university from the perspective of the academic laborer. This is a critique of academic labor in the capitalist university, and they both must go. There is no reforming it. There is no trying to overcome it. It must be abolished. And that brings me back to this issue of how do we do that? Is it transitional? Do we push for a cooperative university? Do we push for cooperative demands? Do we try and get demands through on workload? Do we do something more revolutionary? And what is that then? And also, what do we do about the psychological impact of that? And part of that is because people can't get their heads around it because it's too psychologically damaging, and that's the way civil wars start, right? And that is the end of days. So part of me thinks here quite a lot about that, about Luxembourg's points around barbarism and socialism. And that sort of issue of the issue seem almost feels more urgent. One of the things I was talking about yesterday was about that, about suicide, student suicide, about staff suicide, the absolutely horrendous narrative and story from Diane Anderson about her husband who at Cardiff, Malcolm, who took his own life. It's just gobsmacking, and it makes me almost ashamed to work in institutions, to work in UK higher education, that these things can be allowed to happen. That they're almost turned into, these people are almost turned into kind of surplus. It's just waste material, and it should not be. These are lives. These are people. It's inhumane. So part of this then is this kind of need to come back with Kate to think about the normalization of anxiety-driven overwork. It's kind of culturally acceptable, that it's pathological. It's embedded in the design of a system driven by improving productivity and the accumulation of capital, human capital development, that it's structural and it's automated, it's hyperactive, it's repetitious. It's not a systemic bug. It's baked into the structure of institutions and the sector as a whole. Overwork, anxiety, constant need to perform, constant competition, constant exhaustion. And that this then comes back to these ideas of identity, with the academic peloton moving, oscillating, becoming impactful, excellence, being able to do knowledge transfer, knowledge exchange through overwork, performance management, entrepreneurship, all of that. And along the way, I'm very clear that actually there are certain bodies that end up doing more work and more of the casualized or proletarianized work, and they are generally from academics of color, black academics who are female, pick up a lot of this work, and the intersections of those pick up a lot of that work, the effective work, the work with students, student support, the emotional work in that space, the extra teaching, the fractional work, the precarious work. And that is equally an outrage. So there are two things that are emerging from that. The first is kind of how do we move this idea of the anxiety machine forward, in particular around workload and ill health and ill being, deliberately ill being. And then how do I launch off into kind of thinking about this next project on the Hopeless University, in particular, where that is a kind of a this kind of sense of world weariness, a deeper sense of hopelessness about the academic project. Loss of autonomy, the fact that it appears that academic labour cannot escape from the capitalist university, and that that's redefining a cultural terrain that is all about productivity. And if you're deemed to be not productive enough, in spite of all your caring responsibilities and the fact that you've got housework to do and the fact that you want to go on holiday and the fact that you need to rebuild yourself, then that's a sin. It's sinful. You should be in the laboratory. You should be working 100 hours a week. And in this, there's a, you know, we internalize stuff we should not internalize. We're not good enough, so we kill ourselves, or we self-harm, or we over-medicate, or we self-medicate, or we drink too much whiskey, or whatever it is that we do. And we lose ourselves in our work, and we set ourselves up for constant self-judgment, and it's toxic. So in the next book, I'm thinking about being against the idea of hope in the first case. That the idea is that the kind of uncritical liberal position that the university is a site of hope needs to be dismantled. And I'm interested in developing ideas around terrains of hopelessness that emerge from the university in the global north, and connecting that through then to the idea that a lot of our labour-based struggles are hopeless, and a lot of our positioning around ideas for things like a cooperative university or cooperative practice are hopeless inside the liberal capitalist university. I want then to kind of look at structures in a bit more detail, the structures that delineate hopelessness and the idea that university is a hopeless space. What are the structures around learning and teaching, governance, around management, around workload, all of that, that delineate hopelessness? I'm then interested in kind of the fact that actually this is baked into culture. It's pathological. There's a hopeless form of kind of diseased consciousness inside the institution that is almost unable, because of issues around privilege and status, but also around ideas of fetishizing the career of an academic, around fetishizing the idea that there was that that we can get back to it being a desiring and desirable space. And I'm not interested in going back. I don't believe that going back is, I don't believe that there was ever a golden era. I don't believe there was ever a utopian position. I don't believe in utopias. I maybe believe in utopianism. So there's a thing there then, moving on from this idea that it's pathological into moving into this idea that it's methodological. There is a set of practices, there are a set of practices here that are a method. There's a paradigm here, and I want to unpick that idea of what of how the institution has become methodologically hopeless. In part then to kind of launch off almost that my sister always sort of says, why, what, alienated academic, now the hopeless university, Richard, what's going on? And my starting point is pessimism. Hers is optimism, which I love. Don't understand it, but I love it. Mine is pessimism, pessimism of the intellect, optimism of the will, I guess. So it's that sort of sense of, well, how do we move towards hopeful despair? I despair at what it's become. How do I use that? How might we use that? And how might we develop categories from that, in order to do something different? And I want then to turn to kind of, I guess, kind of critique the idea of hope at the end of history. And I think it's important to say that two of the big influences on me during this process of reading and writing about the Hopeless University have been two podcasts. The first is Auf Hebunga Bunga, which is the global politics podcast at the end of history, which is effectively an argument that we were told by Fukuyama, amongst others, that history had ended, that the Berlin Wall had come down, that was that. That history was off the agenda. There's no alternative to capitalism. There's no alternative to neoliberal forms of governance. This is the way it is. This is liberal democracy. Austerity kicks in, financial crash, the rise of the alt-right, the rise of alt-fascist governments, the series of coups in Latin America and South America, the global climate crisis, and all of a sudden politics is back. We were told this is the end of history, but actually it's the end of history. So I'm very interested in that, and that was the first kind of podcast that's really influenced me. The second is the really rather brilliant communist podcast Swampside Chats. Can't say Swampside Chats. From over in the States. So they kind of a mix of people involved in that, but they are brilliant unpicking of a series of tracts that I guess we would class as kind of almost like the classical kind of communist tracts from Kautsky or Bernstein or Lenin. And also thinking about some more, bringing that up to speed, some work on Postone, amongst others, and also some work in the enemy camp. But there's so much that they are forcing me to address in terms of transitional demands, in terms of issues around communization, in terms of issues around kind of revolution. And what is to be done. And I think that is, I think for academics who are currently out on strike, over pay and conditions, over equality, over casualization, there are some big things to think about in terms of how they join that struggle up to a wider social struggle over social goods, around issues to do with social welfare, healthcare, access to education, all of that kind of stuff. And how do we look not just to fetishize the university and status in that space, but to do something different that is beyond Weltschmerz, that is beyond world weariness, that is beyond abject hopelessness. Right, I've got to go now because I've got to go talk to some people about the process of writing. I thought it was just going to be PhD students. But it's not, it's kind of early career academics as well. So that'll be all very interesting. I hope there are some PhD students there. I've like very much enjoy working with PhD students. always interesting. So it'll be good to try and understand these people's fears. I'm talking about writing anxiety workload, writing anxiety workload, labor anxiety workload. Right, so I'll be back next week. We'll be talking to Rob about his new album, Ray Elbow and the Magic Beans, and I'll close out with a Ray Elbow track. So I will commend that to you. Take care, keep safe, keep warm. Don't forget to vote when the time comes.
Women, the rights of 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 women.
We are having to hammer out for ourselves the right principles of government. We can take them ready-made from no man.
Unconsciously sweep away the rights of women. The rights of women, the rights of women, the rights of women. The rights of women, the rights of women, the rights of women.
If you're weak and ignorant, your rage will, half the time, be not only impotent, but directed against the wrong things and the wrong persons.
And women have had to fight and are still having to fight for every miserable concession in personal freedom and education.
Unconsciously sweep away the rights of women. The rights of women, the rights of women, the rights of women. The rights of women, the rights of women.
Ages restricted women's culture and cramped women's sympathies. Full of vitality and personality, women have felt the heavy hand of brute force upon them. Women have felt the heavy hand of brute force upon them.
Unconsciously sweep away the rights of women. The rights of women, the rights of women, the rights of women. The rights of women, the rights of women.
Man thinks of the qualities he finds desirable in a woman and compounds an ideal woman out of these qualities.
Doubtless, when we are free, we shall suffer fools more gladly than we do now, having less to fear from them.
Unconscious. effortlessly sweep away the rights of women. The rights of women. The rights of women. The rights of women. The rights of women.
It is not possible to study our social institutions without coming to the conclusion that they are the result of the subjection of women, and that many of them tend to perpetuate that subjection. It is inconceivable that women, of their free and enlightened will, would have chosen this position. Unconsciously sweep away the rights of women. The rights of women. The rights of women. The rights of women. The rights of women.